If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio for Tuesday, April 12, 2022. A gunman in an orange construction vest puts on a gas mask, sets off a smoke canister on a rush hour subway train in Brooklyn, New York, and shoots at least 10 people. The manhunt for that gunman continues. New York City Police Commissioner says the attack is not being investigated as terrorism, but she's not ruling out anything. Coming up, we'll hear from the commissioner, also the mayor, New York's governor, and President Biden. President Biden traveling to Iowa to announce an emergency step designed to bring down the cost of gasoline, allowing a 15% ethanol blend called E15 to be sold this summer, the driving season. It's normally not sold in the summer because of environmental concerns. Inflation hitting another 40-year high, up 8.5% in March compared to a year ago, according to a new Labor Department report. We'll talk about it with a Heritage Foundation economist, Peter St. Ange. Russian President Vladimir Putin vowing to press forward with his country's war in Ukraine, claiming he had no other choice but to send in his military. While the Pentagon says it cannot confirm reports that Russia has used chemical weapons in its attack on the Ukrainian city of Mariupol, but they're monitoring it carefully. From ABC News, a gunman donned a gas mask, detonated a smoke canister, and opened fire on a New York City subway train Tuesday morning, shooting 10 people and sparking panic during the rush hour commute. 28 victims have gone to Brooklyn hospitals with various injuries. 5 people are in critical but stable condition. Police describe the gunman, who is still on the run, as an active shooter. That from ABC News. The New York City Police Commissioner Ki-Chen Sewell giving an update in the street in Brooklyn about noon Eastern.
We're to update New Yorkers about an active shooting incident that took place this morning inside the 36th Street subway station on the N Line. I want to begin by assuring the public that there are currently no known explosive devices on our subway trains, and this is not being investigated as an act of terrorism at this time. We can also report that although this was a violent incident, reportedly we have no one with life-threatening injuries as a result of this case. This investigation is only hours old, so please note this information is subject to change. Just before 8:24 this morning, as a Manhattan-bound N train waited to enter the 36th Street station, an individual on that train donned what appeared to be a gas mask. He then took a canister out of his bag and opened it. The train at that time began to fill with smoke. He then opened fire, striking multiple people on the subway and in the platform. Again, we will describe him as an individual. He is being reported as a male black, approximately 5 feet 5 inches tall with a heavy build. He was wearing a green construction type vest and a hooded sweatshirt. The color is gray. At this time, we are working with our federal partners, where we are asking for the public's help. Anyone with information, videos, or photographs, no matter how insignificant they think it may be, is encouraged to call Crime Stoppers at 800-577-TIPS. All calls are strictly confidential.
The New York City Police Commissioner Ki-Chen Sewell, a news conference in the street in Brooklyn near the subway stop where the shooting happened. She referred to those unexploded devices. There were early reports that there were unexploded devices in the station on the train, but they were false reports. It was just that smoke canister that the gunman unleashed. Also speaking at this news conference, New York Governor Kathy Hochul, a Democrat.
This morning, ordinary New Yorkers woke up in anticipation of a relatively normal day. They left their homes en route to school, en route to their jobs, and to a normal day, as I mentioned. That sense of tranquility and normalness was disrupted, brutally disrupted, by an individual so cold-hearted and depraved of heart that they had no caring about the individuals that they assaulted as they simply went about their daily lives. This individual is still on the loose. This person is dangerous. They're asking individuals to be very vigilant and alert. And you'll get more reports on specificity as the day goes on. So this is an active shooter situation right now in the city of New York. I just got off the phone with the mayor. He's recovering well. He is monitoring. He's actively engaged in the situation. I wanted to let him know that the people of the entire state of New York stand with the people of this city, this community, and we say no more. No more mass shootings. No more disrupting lives. No more creating heartbreak for people just trying to live their lives as normal New Yorkers. It has to end, and it ends now. And we are sick and tired of reading headlines about crime, whether they're mass shootings or the loss of a teenage girl or a 13-year-old. It has to stop. I'm committing the full resources of our state to fight this surge of crime, this insanity that is seizing our city, because we want to get back to normal. It has been a long, hard 2 years. That's what we crave, that sense of stability and normalcy. And this is what the mayor and I are going to continue to work toward. And I thank the partners, the brave people of the MTA, the first ones who had the sense, the drivers of the train, to leave the station to make sure no more victims could be hurt. The NYPD, FDNY, state police, everyone involved in this has one purpose. And as to stop the insanity of these crimes.
New York Governor Kathy Hochul at a news conference in Brooklyn near the site of the subway stop where the mass shooting took place. She referred to New York City Mayor Eric Adams, also a Democrat, who was not there because he's tested positive for COVID-19 and is isolating. But Mayor Adams did post a video message about the same time as this news conference around noon Eastern.
My fellow New Yorkers, since early this morning, my team and I have been in constant communication with NYPD, FDNY, EMS, emergency management, and multiple other city agencies, as well as state and federal officials. First, let me say we're praying for all New Yorkers who were injured or affected by today's attack. So far, we know that we have a multiple number of injuries, including victims of gunshot wounds. I wish to thank all of the first responders who responded to the scene or at the local hospitals, helping in today's incidents. You are what make New York the greatest city in the world, and I thank you for supporting your fellow New Yorkers. To today's incident, as of now, we have not found any live explosive devices, but the suspect in today's attack detonated smoke bombs to cause havoc. We will not allow New Yorkers to be terrorized, even by a single individual. NYPD is searching for the suspect at large, and we will find him. But we ask the public to come forward with any information that may help us in this investigation. They can simply call 800-577-TIPS, 800-577-TIPS. We need your assistance.
New York City Mayor Eric Adams in a Twitter video. He is isolating because of testing positive for COVID-19. He later did a remote interview with CNN's Dina Bash, in which he called for a national response to rising violence following the subway shooting that wounded over a dozen people. He said increased violence is an issue affecting the entire country, and that while officials have recovered more than 1,800 guns in the last 3.5 months, the city needs assistance. He said we're going to continue to do our job, but there is some assistance that's going to be needed in our city, such as empowering ATF, referring to the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives. White House saying that President Joe Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris were briefed on the mass shooting. And when President Biden traveled to Iowa today, he spent a minute speaking about that.
To start, I'd like to say a few words about the mass shooting in New York City subway this morning you've all read and heard about. Jill and I, my wife Jill and I, are praying for those who are injured and all those touched by that trauma. And we're grateful for all the first responders who jumped into action, including civilians. civilians who didn't hesitate to help their fellow passengers and try to shield them. My team has been in touch with Mayor Adams and New York's police commissioner, and the Department of Justice and the FBI are working closely with the NYPD on the ground. We're going to continue to stay in close contact with New York authorities and as we learn more about the situation over the coming hours and days. And something could have broken between now and the last hour. I haven't heard the news. I haven't spoken to any of my staff. But we're not letting up on it until we find out and we find the perpetrator.
President Biden in Iowa late afternoon on Tuesday. A spokesman for Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas also saying the secretary has been briefed on the current situation in Brooklyn and is closely following ongoing developments. DHS will continue to provide comprehensive support to NYPD, other local and state officials, and the people of New York. And Senator Chuck Schumer, Democrat and Majority Leader and a Brooklyn native, tweeting, "I'm closely monitoring the situation this morning at the 36th Street Station in Sunset Park and our beloved Brooklyn. I'm praying for all the victims, their families, all those impacted. I'm grateful for the quick action of our first responders. To everyone in New York, stay safe." And a number of other members of Congress not from that area also tweeting. This from Jim Jordan, Republican of Ohio. "Thankful for all the police and first responders in Brooklyn. Prayers for the victims and their families." This is Washington Today. From Associated Press, inflation soared over the past year at its fastest pace in more than 40 years, with costs of food, gasoline, housing, and other necessities squeezing American consumers and wiping out the pay raises that many people have received. Labor Department said Tuesday that its consumer price index jumped 8.5% in March from 12 months earlier, the sharpest year-over-year increase since December 1981. Gas prices accounted for more than half of the monthly jump in prices. Food and housing costs also climbed in March in ways that could weigh on families. That from AP. President Joe Biden in Menlo, Iowa today at the Poet Ethanol Processing Plant, announcing an emergency step he says will reduce gas prices.
"Today, I'm announcing that the environmental, and I don't think as much of an announcement, has already broken out pretty much the last 24 hours, but the Environmental Protection Agency is planning to issue an emergency waiver to allow E15 gasoline that uses more ethanol from homegrown crops to be sold across the United States this summer in order to increase fuel supply." And folks, I feel like, thank you, I feel like, as a minister, and I feel like I'm preaching to the choir here, but here's what it means. E15 is about 10 cents a gallon cheaper than E10, and some gas stations offer an even bigger discount than that. But many of the gas stations that sell it here in Iowa, Illinois, Minnesota, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, are required to stop selling in the summer. But with this waiver, on June 1, you're not going to show up at your local gas station and see a bag over the pump that has the cheapest gas. You're going to be able to keep filling up with E15, and it's going to solve a whole problem. But it's not going to solve all our problems, but it's going to help some people. And I'm committed to doing whatever I can to help, even if it's an extra buck or two in the pockets that they fill up will make a difference in people's lives. And even though E15 is only available in a few thousand pumps today, we're investing more than $100 million to build biofuel infrastructure of the future. Things like blender pumps, the gas pumps that can handle higher blends of bioethanol and diesel fuel. Of course, there's more we need to do to bring down the prices for American families. We're also working to address food prices, because right now, farmers aren't getting a fair deal and nationwide. And neither are families at the grocery store. Back in July, I signed an executive order to promote competition to help level the playing field for many family farmers and ranchers. Because, as many of you here know better than anyone, that four big companies control more than half the market for beef, pork, and poultry, giving ranchers very few choices about who to sell to get their product. These big conglomerates drive down prices they pay farmers, and even as they drive up prices at the grocery store. So we're investing up to $1 billion in the American Rescue Funds for new and expanded meat and poultry processing capacity throughout this country. And this is something I've talked about with Brent Johnson, who is here today. We're going to invest in innovative new products and processors, small businesses, independent businesses, the lifeblood of our economy. It's going to give farmers and ranchers more options to shore up a weak point in our food supply chain and bring down prices for American families. I've said it before and I've said it again. I'm a capitalist, but without capitalism, without competition, isn't capitalism. It's exploitation. Exploitation.
President Joe Biden in Menlo, Iowa, at a bioprocessing plant. That announcement about allowing the E15, 15% ethanol blended gasoline to be sold over the summer. Iowa, and that ethanol is made mostly from corn, Iowa grows the most corn of any state and is the main ingredient. Senator Chuck Grassley, Republican of Iowa, endorsing this proposal. So has Senator Dick Durbin, Democrat from Illinois. Illinois is the second leading corn producing state. And this from agweb.com from Farm Journal. The summertime ban on E15 was imposed over concerns that it contributes to smog in hot weather, though research has shown that the E15 blend of fuel may not increase smog relative to the more common 10% blends sold year-round. More on the inflation report from the Labor Department. Again, the Consumer Price Index up in March compared to a year earlier, 8.5%. The House Republican leader Kevin McCarthy tweeting, "Runaway inflation is crushing American families and our economy. Under President Biden, prices are accelerating faster than at any time in more than 40 years, sucking up paychecks and draining savings. Americans can't afford Democrat one-party rule." And Congressman Kevin Brady, Republican from Texas, ranking member on the Ways and Means Committee, which handles taxes, was on CNBC this morning. It was just before the latest inflation numbers came out.
I've seen a chart making its way on social media that shows where inflation took off, and I don't know, they peg it to Inauguration Day in 2021. And it does coincide with that, but I'm just trying to figure out exactly what we think happened in terms of legislation and proposals from the Biden administration. Because we were dealing with COVID, so we tried to help people out, and a lot of stimulus got out there at the same time that we were reopening and there were supply chain problems. So you got too much money chasing too few goods. So that's probably what caused most of the inflation. But how could we have done anything differently just in terms of trying to deal with COVID?
Yeah, and I think a fair assessment of this is that it didn't necessarily start on President Biden's inauguration day, but certainly in March when Democrats rammed through that $1.9 trillion American Rescue Plan. That's where inflation really took off in a serious way and has continued to accelerate. Right now, we'll see the new numbers this morning, but as you know, anything over 0.4% is another monthly pay cut for families and workers. I also think there was a hangover from some of the COVID area programs that had very lavish unemployment benefits, very lavish health care benefits, and a child tax credit no longer tied to work. I think that exacerbated the worker shortage, which again made inflation and prices harder higher for longer. So I think those were the key elements, the spending, the timing, and I think benefits that extended way beyond where the recovery demanded it.
Congressman Kevin Brady, Republican from Texas, Tuesday morning on CNBC's Squawk Box. More on the inflation report. We're joined by Peter St. Ange, economist at the Heritage Foundation. Thank you very much for being here. Each month now that goes by shows inflation accelerating. You wrote a week ago, we should not have to endure an economy always teetering on a knife's edge, and that's all Biden has offered with the excuses to go with it. Can you elaborate a little bit more on that?
Sure. So inflation, during the last year of Trump, annual inflation was running at about 1.4%. Almost immediately when Biden came in, inflation started ramping up, and you know, it hit about 7.5% before Putin invaded Ukraine. And you know, Ukraine or Putin at the moment is sort of Biden's go-to excuse. Now, during those 13, 14 months, Biden or the administration has had just this rotating cast of excuses, been everything under the sun. First, it was COVID, supply chain, too many people buying exercise cycles, global warming, online shopping. I mean, anything to, you know, try to pin this inflation on things that are outside their control. And the fact of the matter is that the main thing that has been driving inflation has been the enormous amount of spending. This, you know, administration has been, I mean, it's been shooting for a whole lot more spending, but that spending has crashed into, you know, supply chains that weren't ready for it. The sort of war on energy, you know, Biden made a lot of promises to activists on the way in that he was going to reduce oil production, and indeed he did. And it turns out oil is kind of important for families. So the inflation is really just hitting across the economy at this point. One of the worst bits of news out of this latest inflation report that just came out today was that it's really hitting grocery prices. So what they call food at home. And that was up about 1.5% on the month, which is pretty brutal.
So if you were to be giving President Biden some advice on one or two things he should be doing right now, what would that be?
The fastest things to do is, number one, cut the spending. The spending pushes the Federal Reserve into kind of a no-win situation where the Fed is trying to accommodate all of this federal spending coming out of Washington, and then they've got to do, you know, things with inflation rates and quantitative easing and all these, you know, they've got all these technical means to try to accommodate all of that spending. So, I mean, that's, you know, number one, they've got to cut the spending. Number two is sort of end the war on production, right? Specifically on energy. So, you know, make it easy to drill, easy to transport, whether it's a pipeline. Now, a lot of those things take time to build, but simply signaling to the market that there's going to be a lot more supply coming on, that tends to, you know, it releases oil that's in inventory and such. So you can have a pretty, you know, large impact just from those factors alone. There are other reforms. We've suggested a number of things where, you know, they could make reforms to how ports are run, these sort of green mandates that have hit trucking and trains and really across the board. There's a number of sort of good governance things that they could do that would reduce prices in general. But really, spending and that war on energy, those are probably the two biggest things, which it's very unlikely that he's going to do any of those because his activist base does not want those.
We're talking with Peter St. Ange from the Heritage Foundation. On the flip side, if President Biden and the Democrats controlling Congress continue doing what they think ought to be done, where do you see inflation going in the future? When will it reach its peak, and how high will it go?
This is the big question on Wall Street. How much of the current inflation is coming from sort of special factors, whether that's, you know, energy prices? The war in Ukraine certainly did make energy jump, at least temporarily. Supply chain constrictions. China has been shutting down entire cities, but also ports. China, of course, exports not only consumer goods, but it also exports parts. And then those parts are used in American factories, so that can have a ripple effect. So on the one hand, a lot of those transitory things hopefully will sort themselves out. COVID was indeed a massive the COVID lockdowns were a massive disruption to the world economy. So some of those should sort out. On the other hand, so that's sort of the good news. But then the bad news is that they are continuing to spend enormous amounts. They're chomping at the bit for more. If they hold on to Congress in, you know, upcoming elections, then we can expect that to continue. And so in that case, inflation could actually continue to get worse.
Are you willing to put a number on it?
If they don't straighten out, and if they continue with the spending spree, then I would say definitely getting into the double digits.
P. Peter St. Ange is a research fellow, economist at the Heritage Foundation. Follow his work at heritage.org and on Twitter at Prof. St. Ange. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Enjoyed it.
Wall Street today, the Dow down 67, NASDAQ down 40, S&P down 15. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says that 2021 was the deadliest year in U.S. history. 3.465 million deaths, just under 3.5 million, beats 2020's record number by 80,000. Coronavirus deaths accounted for 415,000. Of those deaths, there were also rising deaths due to drug overdoses and from cancer, diabetes, liver disease, and stroke. Oklahoma Governor Kevin Stitt, a Republican, has signed into law one of the strictest anti-abortion bills in the country. It makes it a felony to perform an abortion, punishable by up to 10 years in prison and a $100,000 fine. The only exception is to save the life of the mother. And this comes as the U.S. Supreme Court will decide in late June or early July, which is expected, a case challenging Mississippi's abortion law that bans abortions after 15 weeks of pregnancy. And it is possible that that ruling could weaken or even overturn the landmark cases that have made abortion a constitutional right, leaving it up to the states. Here's Governor Stitt in Oklahoma City.
I promised Oklahomans that I would sign every pro-life bill that hit my desk. And that's what we're doing here today. Senate Bill 612 passed with a vote of 38-9 in the Senate and 70-14 in the House. That's over 80% support in both chambers. The bill's authors, Senator Dahm and Representative Olson, are here today. Thank you so much for your leadership. Thank you, Senator. You'll hear from them directly here in a few minutes. And as governor, I represent all 4 million Oklahomans, and they overwhelmingly support protecting life in the state of Oklahoma. We want Oklahoma to be the most pro-life state in the country. We want to outlaw abortion in the state of Oklahoma. Attorney General John O'Connor and I know this bill will be challenged immediately by liberal activists from the coast who always seem to want to come in and dictate and mandate and challenge our way of life here in the state of Oklahoma. But the most important thing is to take a stand and protect the unborn and protect life in the state of Oklahoma. We believe every life is precious. As a father of six, those are my core beliefs. And I'm elected by all 4 million Oklahomans to represent them and to put our beliefs into law.
Oklahoma Governor Kevin Stitt. The bill he signed today takes effect 90 days after the legislature adjourns next month. Abortion rights advocates promise they'll challenge it in court. As mentioned, there's also the U.S. Supreme Court cases involving abortion laws in other states that could impact this. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki putting out a statement that reads, "Make no mistake, the actions today in Oklahoma are part of a disturbing national trend attacking women's rights, and the Biden administration will continue to stand with women in Oklahoma and across the country in the fight to defend their freedom to make their own choices about their futures." Jen Psaki also calling on behalf of the White House for Congress to pass legislation to codify the 1973 Roe v. Wade Supreme Court decision that legalized abortion, that bill in Congress titled the Women's Health Protection Act. Washington Today continues in a minute. Welcome back to Washington Today, available as a podcast on the free C-SPAN Now mobile video app and wherever you get your podcasts. A few more headlines from Associated Press. New York Lieutenant Governor Brian Benjamin arrested Tuesday in a federal corruption investigation. AP writes it creates a political crisis for Governor Kathy Hochul 7 months after she selected Benjamin as a partner to make a fresh start in an office already rocked by scandal. Benjamin, a Democrat, accused in an indictment of participating in a scheme to obtain campaign contributions from a real estate developer in exchange for Benjamin's agreement to use his influence as a state senator to get a $50,000 grant of state funds for a nonprofit organization the developer controlled. And South Dakota House on Tuesday impeached the state attorney general, Jason Ravsborg, over a 2020 car crash in which he killed a pedestrian but initially said he might have struck a deer or another large animal. Ravsborg, a Republican, is the first official to be impeached in South Dakota's history. He'll be temporarily removed from office pending the Senate trial, where it takes a two-thirds majority to convict on impeachment charges. Russian President Vladimir Putin, reports Reuters, on Tuesday defended the war in Ukraine as a noble mission that would achieve its goals as his troops massed for a new offensive amid allegations of rape, brutality against civilians, and possible use of chemical weapons. Putin speaking in Russia's Far East at a ceremony marking the 61st anniversary of the Soviet Union putting the first man into space, spoke defiantly despite Western abhorrence at his actions and the imposition of wide-ranging international sanctions on his country. That from Reuters. Here's the president.
It's an obvious thing. It was unavoidable. The only question was one of timing. The thing we do, on one hand, we help people, saving them from Nazism. On the other hand, we take measures to ensure Russia's own security. It's obvious we had no other choice. It's the right decision. We have no doubt our goals will be achieved.
President Putin today also meeting with the president of his ally Belarus, where he said that peace talks with Ukraine had reached a dead end because Ukraine had made fake claims about war crimes. Overnight, the New York Times reported the U.S. and other Western countries are investigating claims that Russian forces may have used chemical weapons dropped by a drone in Mariupol. It's held by Ukrainian forces at the moment, although most of the city is not. President Joe Biden warning a few weeks ago that if Russian forces use chemical weapons in Ukraine, it would trigger a response in kind from NATO. More on this from today's Pentagon briefing with spokesperson John Kirby.
I wanted to follow up on your statement last night about reports of chemical munition use by the Russians in Mariupol. And you said in that statement that you've had, that the U.S. has had concerns about Russia potentially mixing riot control agents, tear gas, with chemical agents. Can you give us a bit more of the U.S. assessment on that? Is this something, relatively new that you've been tracking since the invasion and all the aggressive action by Russia? Is this more something that you've been seeing for some time? Can you give us some context and perspective on this notion that they may be mixing up their own version of chemical agents?
Well, look, I think, as you know, we have tried to share with you intelligence that that we see and we feel that we can that we can and we should make public. And And this is something we have had justified reason to be concerned about, that in the prosecution of this war, that this could be a tactic they might employ, which is to try to mask a potential more serious chemical attack with riot control agents. Again, it comes from a mosaic of information we've gleaned. It's related more to what is unfolding in Ukraine rather than some long historical practice. Although I would add that the Russians have certainly proven more than willing to use chemical weapons when it suited them in the past. I mean, this is a military that has a history here, but it's more related to what we've been picking up in terms of the invasion of Ukraine. I want to add, though, Barb, as I also said in that statement last night, that we cannot confirm these reports of the that have been emanating on social media about the use of potential chemical agents through the social media reporting was through the use of a drone or something like that. And we just are not able to confirm it. We're obviously taking it seriously, and we're monitoring it. We're trying to do the best we can to figure out what, if anything, happened, but we're not in a position to confirm it right now.
Pentagon Press Secretary John Kirby answering a question from CNN to Pentagon correspondent Barbara Starr. Congressman Mike Waltz, Republican of Florida, former member of the U.S. Army Special Forces, the Green Berets, telling Fox News Channel today that any use of chemical weapons by Russia should be a red line set by the U.S. and other NATO countries.
Congressman, if true, what do NATO and the U.S. need to do in response? Well, this is part of the Russian doctrine, and it's certainly part of Putin's doctrine to escalate to weapons of mass destruction. It would not surprise me if this is true, and particularly because the Russian general that just took over command of operations in Ukraine was also the general in charge in Syria, where both the Syrians and Russians repeatedly used chemical weapons. We'll remember President Trump infamously or famously, whichever you want to use, sending cruise missiles in to take those capabilities out. President Biden should have been setting red lines from the beginning with the use of weapons of mass destruction. I believe that red line should have been that would be the line for NATO to become directly involved. We cannot allow chemical weapons or, God forbid, tactical nuclear weapons to be the next rung in the escalation ladder that we allow Putin to go to.
Congressman Mike Walls, Republican from Florida, today on Fox News Channel. Story at Politico.com reads that 90 years ago, Joseph Stalin's Soviet regime inflicted a devastating famine on Ukraine, killing 3.9 million people in what has been known as the Holodomor, or genocide by hunger. Now Vladimir Putin, whose invasion has stalled in the battlefield, is trying to starve Ukraine into submission again. Russian troops have laid waste to farmland, destroying agriculture equipment and planting landmines in the rich soil where crops should grow. Ukraine's traditional supply routes have been wrecked, its ports now under Russian control. In Washington, Congressman James McGovern, Democrat from Massachusetts, co-chair of the Lantos Human Rights Commission, opened a hearing today about the use of food as a weapon of war.
Conflict is not the only cause of hunger, but it is a main driver in 8 out of 10 of the worst hunger crises in the world today. This was already the case before Russia launched its war of aggression against Ukraine, a main supplier of wheat to Africa and the Middle East. I want to emphasize that we're not talking about collateral damage. We're talking about intentional decisions to wage war in ways that directly or indirectly undermine people's access to food and put them at risk for starvation. This happened in Syria when civilians were trapped in besieged cities. It is happening in Ethiopia as people are systematically denied access to humanitarian relief. And it happened in Burma, where destruction of farmland and villages, along with restrictions on movement, were used against Rohingya. The link between conflict and hunger and starvation is well known. 4 years ago, the UN Security Council adopted Resolution 2417 that explicitly recognized the link between armed conflict, food insecurity, and famine, and recalled that international humanitarian law, prohibits the use of hunger as a weapon. In fact, to intentionally cause starvation of civilians is a war crime, a violation of both the Geneva Conventions and the Rome Statute. When people hear the words war crime, starving civilians is probably not the first thing that comes to mind. We're more likely to think about the bombing of whole cities, the destruction of medical facilities, killing civilians in cold blood, the kinds of images we're seeing come out of Ukraine as we speak. And that's why I wanted to hold this hearing today. We need to shift our thinking about hunger and starvation when these are linked to armed conflict. We should not assume that hunger is somehow a natural consequence of war. We should be asking whether it's the result of intentional decisions that make it a war crime. And if investigations show a war crime, we should be insisting on accountability for those responsible.
Congressman James McGovern is co-chair of the Lantos Human Rights Commission. He's a Democrat from Massachusetts. The other co-chair, Chris Smith, Republican from New Jersey. A hearing today about food and war. C-SPAN covered it all, and you can find the full video at cspan.org. An annual human rights report, writes Bloomberg News, by the State Department contends that authoritarianism around the world is threatening human rights and democracy, most strikingly as Russia continues its attack on Ukraine. This report, by the way, for 2021 was put together before Russia's February invasion. More from Secretary of State Antony Blinken today at the State Department.
In few places have the human consequences of this decline been as stark as they are in the Russian government's brutal war on Ukraine. That's especially true in recent weeks, as Russian forces have been pushed back from towns and cities they occupied or surrounded, and evidence mounts of their widespread atrocities. we see what this receding tide is leaving in its wake. The bodies, hands bound, left on streets. The theaters, train stations, apartment buildings, reduced to rubble with civilians inside. We hear it in the testimonies of women and girls who've been raped and the besieged civilians starving and freezing to death. In response, people and governments in every region are voicing their condemnation and calling for those responsible to be held accountable. This global outcry has been clarifying. In its disdain for human life and dignity, the Kremlin has reinvigorated a belief in people worldwide that there are human rights that everyone, everywhere, should enjoy, and underscored why these rights are worth defending. At the same time, civil society, governments, and people around the world are rightly pointing out that Ukraine is, tragically, far from the only place where gross abuses are being perpetrated. They want the international community to shine a spotlight on human rights abuses wherever they're being committed, and to bring the same urgency to stopping abuses and holding perpetrators accountable. The United States shares that goal. This report is just one of the ways that we're working to achieve it. It contains individual chapters on nearly 200 countries and territories, each of which offers factual, objective, and thorough accounting of their records on internationally recognized human rights. Whether a country is a friend or one with which we have real differences, the measuring stick we apply is the same. That reflects a core principle of human rights. They're universal. People of every nationality, race, gender, disability, and age are entitled to these rights, no matter what they believe, whom they love, or any other characteristics. This is especially important as a number of governments continue to claim falsely that human rights need to be applied based on the local context. Little coincidence that many of the same governments are among the worst abusers of human rights.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken at the State Department, the release of the 2021 Country Reports on Human Rights Practices, the 46th annual report. China has responded to frequent criticism of this report over the years by releasing its own report titled Human Rights Record of the United States. Finally, on Washington Today, from Great Britain, reports that Prime Minister Boris Johnson is going to be fined by the police for attending a birthday party thrown for him during a COVID lockdown in 2020. Also receiving a fine, the Chancellor Rishi Sunak. This is officially known as an FPN, a fixed penalty notice. Comes as the Metropolitan Police continue their investigation into illegal parties at 10 Downing Street. BBC News says that Mr. Johnson's fine makes him the UK's first serving prime minister to be sanctioned for breaking the law, and that Labour leader Sir Keir Starmer, Scotland's first minister, and the Scottish National Party leader Nicola Sturgeon, and Wales Labour first minister Mark Drakeford are among those calling for both the prime minister and the chancellor to resign. You can add to that the Liberal Democratic Party leader, Ed Davey. He was interviewed on GB News.
Our great country cannot have criminals and liars leading our government, especially at a time of national and international crisis. Let's remember, millions of people made huge sacrifices during the pandemic. And it's clear now that Boris Johnson and Rishi Sunak just took them for granted. And while they were breaking the law, partying in Downing Street, they're just not fit to hold office. And if they had a shred of decency, they would resign.
Prime Minister Boris Johnson saying today that he has paid this fine. He apologizes, but he will not resign.
Today, I've received a fixed penalty notice from the Metropolitan Police relating to an event in Downing Street on the 19th of June 2020. And let me say immediately that I've paid the fine and I once again offer a full apology. And in a spirit of openness and humility, I want to be completely clear about what happened on that date. My day began shortly after 7 a.m., and I chaired 8 meetings in Number 10, including the Cabinet Committee deciding COVID strategy. I visited a school in Hemel Hempstead, which took me out of Downing Street for over 4 hours. And amongst all these engagements, on a day that happened to be my birthday, there was a brief gathering in the cabinet room shortly after 2 p.m., lasting for less than 10 minutes, during which people I work with kindly passed on their good wishes. And I have to say, in all frankness, at that time, it did not occur to me that this might have been a breach of the rules. But of course, the police have found otherwise, and I fully respect the outcome of their investigation. I understand the anger that many will feel, that I myself fell short when it came to observing the very rules which the government I lead had introduced to protect the public. And I accept in all sincerity that people had the right to expect better. And now I feel an even greater sense of obligation to deliver on the priorities of the British people, strengthening our economy, creating jobs and opportunity, levelling up across the whole of the United Kingdom. Now, of course, ensuring that Putin fails in Ukraine and easing the burden on hard-working families caused by higher energy prices. I will take that forward, that task, with due humility, but with maximum determination to fulfil my duty and do what is best for the country I serve.
British Prime Minister Boris Johnson, leader of the Conservative Party. Thanks for listening to Washington Today. For more top Washington stories sent right to you each day, subscribe to C-SPAN's evening newsletter word for word. You can sign up at c-span.org/connect. Have a good night.